Chapter 8.
"Sorry to have kept you waiting," said Mayor Whittaker, "but you know the way it is. The chief's been in conference for the last hour. I've only just been able to get hold of him myself to tell him you're here. This way, we'll take the shortcut through records." It might have been an ordinary office on Earth. The door said simply enough, "Chief Executive." There was no name. It wasn't necessary. Everyone in the solar system knew who ran Mars. Indeed, it was difficult to think of the planet without thinking of Warren Hadfield at the same time. Gibson was surprised, when he rose from his desk, to see that the chief executive was a good deal shorter than he had imagined. He must have judged the man by his works, and had never guessed that he could give him a couple of inches in height. But the thin, wiry frame and sensitive, rather bird-like head were exactly as he had expected. The interview began with Gibson somewhat on the defensive, for so much depended on his making a good impression. His way would be infinitely easier if he had the chief on his side. In fact, if he made an enemy of Hadfield, he might just as well go home right away.
"I hope Whittaker's been looking after you," said the chief when the initial courtesies had been exchanged. "You'll realize that I couldn't see you before. I've only just got back from an inspection. How are you settling down here?"
"Quite well," smiled Gibson. "I'm afraid I've broken a few things by leaving them in mid-air, but I'm getting used to living with gravity again."
"And what do you think of our little city?"
"It's a remarkable achievement. I don't know how you managed to do so much in the time."
Hadfield was eyeing him narrowly.
"Be perfectly frank. It's smaller than you expected, isn't it?"
Gibson hesitated.
"Well, I suppose it is, but then I'm used to the standards of London and New York. After all, 2,000 people would only make a large village back on Earth. Such a lot of Port Lowell's underground, too, and that makes a difference."
The chief executive seemed neither annoyed nor surprised.
"Everyone has a disappointment when they see Mars' largest city," he said. "Still, it's going to be a lot bigger in another week when the new dome goes up. Tell me, just what are your plans now you've got here? I suppose you know I wasn't very much in favor of this visit in the first place."
"I gathered that on Earth," said Gibson, a little taken aback. He had yet to discover that frankness was one of the chief executive's major virtues. It was not one that endeared him to many people.
"I suppose you were afraid I'd get in the way."
"Yes, but now you're here, we'll do the best for you. I hope you'll do the same for us."
"In what way?"
asked Gibson, stiffening defensively. Hadfield leaned across the table and clasped his hands together with an almost feverish intensity.
"We're at war, Mr. Gibson. We're at war with Mars and all the forces it can bring against us. Cold, lack of water, lack of air. And we're at war with Earth. It's a paper war, true, but it's got its victories and defeats. I'm fighting a campaign at the end of a supply line that's never less than 50 million kilometers long. The most urgent goods take at least 5 months to reach me, and I only get them if Earth decides I can't manage any other way. I suppose you realize what I'm fighting for. My primary objective, that is. It's self-sufficiency. Remember that the first expeditions had to bring everything with them. Well, we can provide all the basic necessities of life now from our own resources. Our workshops can make almost anything that isn't too complicated. But it's all a question of manpower. There are some very specialized goods that simply have to be made on Earth, and until our population's at least 10 times as big, we can't do much about it. Everyone on Mars is an expert at something, but there are more skilled trades back on Earth than there are people on this planet, and it's no use arguing with arithmetic. You see those graphs over there? I started keeping them 5 years ago. They show our production index for various key materials. We've reached the self-sufficiency level, that horizontal red line, for about half of them. I hope that in another 5 years, there will be very few things we'll have to import from Earth. Even now, our greatest need is manpower, and that's where you may be able to help us."
Gibson looked a little uncomfortable.
"I can't make any promises. Please remember that I'm here purely as a reporter. Emotionally, I'm on your side, but I've got to describe the facts as I see them."
"I appreciate that. But facts aren't everything. What I hope you'll explain to Earth is the things we hope to do, just as much as the things we've done. They're even more important. But
We can achieve them only if Earth gives us its support. Not all your predecessors have realized that."
That was perfectly true, thought Gibson. He remembered a critical series of articles in the Daily Telegraph about a year before. The facts had been quite accurate, but a similar account of the first settlers' achievements after 5 years' colonization of North America would probably have been just as discouraging.
"I think I can see both sides of the question," said Gibson. "You've got to realize that from the point of view of Earth, Mars is a long way away, costs a lot of money, and doesn't offer anything in return. The first glamour of interplanetary exploration is worn off. Now people are asking, what do we get out of it? So far, the answer's been very little. I'm convinced that your work is important, but in my case, it's an act of faith rather than a matter of logic. The average man back on Earth probably thinks the millions you're spending here can be better used improving his own planet, when he thinks of it at all, that is."
"I understand your difficulty. It's a common one, and it isn't easy to answer. Let me put it this way. I suppose more intelligent people would admit the value of a scientific base on Mars, devoted to pure research and investigation?"
"Undoubtedly.
But they can't see the purpose of building up a self-contained culture, which may eventually become an independent civilization?"
"That's the trouble, precisely. They don't believe it's possible, or, granted the possibility, don't think it's worthwhile. You'll often see articles pointing out that Mars will always be a drag on the home planet because of the tremendous natural difficulties under which you're laboring."
"What about the analogy between Mars and the American colonies?"
"It can't be pressed too far. After all, men could breathe the air and find food to eat when they got to America."
"That's true. But though the problem of colonizing Mars is so much more difficult, we've got enormously greater powers at our control. Given time and material, we can make this a world as good to live on as Earth. Even now, you won't find many of our people who want to go back. They know the importance of what they're doing. Earth may not need Mars yet, but one day it will."
"I wish I could believe that," said Gibson, a little unhappily.
He pointed to the rich green tide of vegetation that lapped like a hungry sea against the almost invisible dome of the city, at the great plain that hurried so swiftly over the edge of the curiously close horizon, and at the scarlet hills within whose arms the city lay.
"Mars is an interesting world, even a beautiful one, but it can never be like Earth."
"Why should it be? And what do you mean by Earth, anyway? Do you mean the South American pampas, the vineyards of France, the coral islands of the Pacific, the Siberian steppes? Earth is every one of those. Wherever men can live, that will be home to someone someday. And sooner or later, men will be able to live on Mars without all this." He waved towards the dome which floated above the city and gave it life.
"Do you really think," protested Gibson, "that men can ever adapt themselves to the atmosphere outside? They won't be men any longer if they do."
For a moment, the chief executive did not reply. Then he remarked quietly, "I said nothing about men adapting themselves to Mars. Have you ever considered the possibility of Mars meeting us halfway?" He left Gibson just sufficient time to absorb the words. Then, before his visitor could frame the questions that were leaping to his mind, Hadfield rose to his feet. "Well, I hope Whittaker looks after you and shows you everything you want to see. You'll understand that the transport situation's rather tight, but we'll get you to all the outposts if you give us time to make the arrangements. Let me know if there's any difficulty." The dismissal was polite and, at least for the time being, final. The busiest man on Mars had given Gibson a generous portion of his time, and his questions would have to wait until the next opportunity. "What do you think of the chief, now you've met him?" said Mayor Whittaker when Gibson had returned to the outer office.
"He was very pleasant and helpful," replied Gibson cautiously. "Quite an enthusiast about Mars, isn't he?"
Whittaker pursed his lips.
"I'm not sure that's the right word. I think he regards Mars as an enemy to be beaten. So do we all, of course. But the chief's got better reasons than most.
You'd heard about his wife, hadn't you?"
"No."
"She was one of the first people to die of Martian fever 2 years after they came here."
"Oh," said Gibson slowly. "I see. I suppose that's one reason why there's been such an effort to find a cure."
"Yes, the chief's very much set on it. Besides, it's such a drain on our resources. We can't afford to be sick here." That last remark, thought Gibson as he crossed Broadway, so-called because it was all of 15 meters wide, almost summed up the position of the colony. He had still not quite recovered from his initial disappointment at finding how small Port Lowell was, and how deficient in all the luxuries to which he was accustomed on Earth. With its rows of uniform metal houses and few public buildings, it was more of a military camp than a city, though the inhabitants had done their best to brighten it up with terrestrial flowers. Some of these had grown to impressive sizes under the low gravity, and Oxford Circus was now ablaze with sunflowers thrice the height of a man. Though they were getting rather a nuisance, no one had the heart to suggest their removal. If they continued at their present rate of growth, it would soon take a skilled lumberjack to fell them without endangering the port hospital. Gibson continued thoughtfully up Broadway until he came to Marble Arch at the meeting point of Domes 1 and 2. It was also, as he had quickly found, a meeting point in many other ways. Here, strategically placed near the multiple airlocks, was George's, the only bar on Mars.
"Morning, Mr. Gibson," said George. "Hope the chief was in good temper."
As he had left the administration building less than 10 minutes ago, Gibson thought this was pretty quick work. He was soon to find that news traveled very rapidly in Port Lowell, and most of it seemed to be routed through George. George was an interesting character. Since tavern keepers were regarded as only relatively and not absolutely essential for the well-being of the port, he had two official professions. On Earth he had been a well-known stage entertainer, but the unreasonable demands of the 3 or 4 wives he had acquired in a rush of youthful enthusiasm had made him decide to emigrate. He was now in charge of the port's little theater, and seemed to be perfectly contented with life. Being in the middle 40s, he was one of the oldest men on Mars.
"We've got a show on next week," he remarked, when he had served Gibson. "One or two quite good turns. Hope you'll be coming along."
"Certainly," said Gibson. "I'll look forward to it. How often do you have this sort of thing?"
"About once a month. We have film shows 3 times a week, so we don't really do too badly. I'm glad Port Lowell has some nightlife."
"You'd be surprised. Still, I'd better not tell you about that, or you'll be writing it all up in the papers."
"I don't write for that sort of newspaper," retorted Gibson, sipping thoughtfully at the local brew. It wasn't at all bad when you got used to it, though, of course, it was completely synthetic, the joint offspring of hydroponic farm and chemical laboratory. The bar was quite deserted, for at this time of day everyone in Port Lowell would be hard at work. Gibson pulled out his notebook and began to make careful entries, whistling a little tune as he did so. It was an annoying habit, of which he was quite unconscious, and George counterattacked by turning up the bar radio. For once, it was a live program, beamed to Mars from somewhere on the night side of Earth, punched across space by heaven knows how many megawatts, then picked up and rebroadcast by the station on the low hills to the south of the city. Reception was good, apart from a trace of solar noise, static from that infinitely greater transmitter against whose background Earth was broadcasting. Gibson wondered if it was really worth all this trouble to send the voice of a somewhat mediocre soprano and a light orchestra from world to world. But half of Mars was probably listening with varying degrees of sentimentality and homesickness, both of which would be indignantly denied. Gibson finished the list of several score questions he had to ask someone. He still felt rather like a new boy at his first school. Everything was so strange, nothing could be taken for granted. It was hard to believe that 20 meters on the other side of that transparent bubble lay a sudden death by suffocation. Somehow this feeling had never worried him on the Ares. After all, space was like that. But it seemed all wrong here, where one could look out across that brilliant green plain, now a battlefield on which the hardy Martian plants fought their annual struggle for existence, a struggle which would end in death for victors and vanquished alike with the coming of winter. Suddenly Gibson felt an almost overwhelming desire to leave the narrow streets and go out beneath the open sky. For almost the first time, he found himself really missing Earth.
the planet he had thought had so little more to offer him. Like Falstaff, he felt like babbling of green fields, with the added irony that green fields were all around him, tantalizingly visible, yet barred from him by the laws of nature.
"George," said Gibson abruptly, "I've been here a while, and I haven't been outside yet. I'm not supposed to without someone to look after me. You won't have any customers for an hour or so. Be a sport and take me out through the airlock, just for 10 minutes.
No doubt, thought Gibson a little sheepishly, George considered this a pretty crazy request. He was quite wrong. It had happened so often before that George took it very much for granted. After all, his job was attending to the whims of his customers, and most of the new boys seemed to feel this way after their first few days under the dome. George shrugged his shoulders philosophically, wondering if he should apply for additional credits as port psychotherapist, and disappeared into his inner sanctum. He came back a moment later, carrying a couple of breathing masks and their auxiliary equipment.
"We won't want the whole works on a nice day like this," he said, while Gibson clumsily adjusted his gear. "Make sure that sponge rubber fits snugly around your neck. All right, let's go. But only 10 minutes, mind."
Gibson followed eagerly, like a sheepdog behind its master, until they came to the dome exit. There were two locks here, a large one, wide open, leading into Dome 2, and a smaller one which led out onto the open landscape. It was simply a metal tube, about 3 meters in diameter, leading through the glass brick wall which anchored the flexible plastic envelope of the dome to the ground. There were 4 separate doors, none of which could be opened unless the remaining 3 were closed. Gibson fully approved of these precautions, but it seemed a long time before the last of the doors swung inwards from its seals, and that vivid green plain lay open before him. His exposed skin was tingling under the reduced pressure, but the thin air was reasonably warm, and he soon felt quite comfortable. Completely ignoring George, he ploughed his way briskly through the low, closely packed vegetation, wondering as he did why it clustered so thickly round the dome. Perhaps it was attracted by the warmth of the slow seepage of oxygen from the city. He stopped after a few 100 meters, feeling at last clear of that oppressive canopy, and once more under the open sky of heaven. The fact that his head, at least, was still totally enclosed somehow didn't seem to matter. He bent down and examined the plants among which he was standing, knee-deep. He had, of course, seen photographs of Martian plants many times before. They were not really very exciting, and he was not enough of a botanist to appreciate their peculiarities. Indeed, if he had met such plants in some out-of-the-way part of Earth, he would hardly have looked at them twice. None were higher than his waist, and those around him now seemed to be made of sheets of brilliant green parchment, very thin but very tough, designed to catch as much sunlight as possible without losing precious water. These ragged sheets were spread like little sails in the sun, whose progress across the sky they would follow until they dipped westwards at dusk. Gibson wished there were some flowers to add a touch of contrasting color to the vivid emerald, but there were no flowers on Mars. Perhaps there had been once, when the air was thick enough to support insects, but now most of the Martian plant life was self-fertilized. George caught up with him and stood regarding the natives with a morose indifference. Gibson wondered if he was annoyed at being so summarily dragged out of doors, but his qualms of conscience were unjustified. George was simply brooding over his next production, wondering whether to risk a Noel Coward play after the disaster that had resulted the last time his company had tried its hand with period pieces. Suddenly he snapped out of his reverie and said to Gibson, his voice thin but clearly audible over this short distance, "This is rather amusing. Just stand still for a minute and watch that plant in your shadow." Gibson obeyed this peculiar instruction. For a moment, nothing happened. Then he saw that, very slowly, the parchment sheets were folding in on one another. The whole process was over in about 3 minutes. At the end of that time, the plant had become a little ball of green paper, tightly crumpled together, and only a fraction of its previous size. George chuckled.
"It thinks night's fallen," he said, "and doesn't want to be caught napping when the sun's gone.
If you move away, it will think things over for half an hour before it risks opening shop again. You could probably give it a nervous breakdown if you kept this up all day."
"Are these plants any use?" said Gibson. "I mean, can they be eaten, or do they contain any valuable chemicals?"
"They certainly can't be eaten. They're not poisonous, but they'd make you feel mighty unhappy. You see, they're not really like plants on Earth at all. That green is just a coincidence. It isn't, what do you call the stuff?
Chlorophyll?"
"Yes, they don't depend on the air as our plants do. Everything they need they get from the ground. In fact, they can grow in a complete vacuum, like the plants on the moon, if they've got suitable soil and enough sunlight."
Quite a triumph of evolution, thought Gibson. But to what purpose, he wondered. Why had life clung so tenaciously to this little world, despite the worst that nature could do? Perhaps the chief executive had obtained some of his own optimism from these tough and resolute plants.
"Hey," said George, "it's time to go back."
Gibson followed meekly enough. He no longer felt weighed down by that claustrophobic oppression which was, he knew, partly due to the inevitable reaction at finding Mars something of an anticlimax. Those who had come here for a definite job and hadn't been given time to brood would probably bypass this stage altogether. But he had been turned loose to collect his impressions, and so far his chief one was a feeling of helplessness as he compared what man had so far achieved on Mars with the problems still to be faced. Why, even now, 3/4 of the planet was still unexplored. That was some measure of what remained to be done. The first days at Port Lowell had been busy and exciting enough. It had been a Sunday when he had arrived, and Mayor Whittaker had been sufficiently free from the cares of office to show him round the city personally, once he had been installed in one of the 4 suites of the Grand Martian Hotel. The other 3 had not yet been finished. They had started at Dome 1, the first to be built, and the mayor had proudly traced the growth of his city from a group of pressurized huts only 10 years ago. It was amusing and rather touching to see how the colonists had used, wherever possible, the names of familiar streets and squares from their own faraway cities. There was also a scientific system of numbering the streets in Port Lowell, but nobody ever used it. Most of the living houses were uniform metal structures, 2 stories high, with rounded corners and rather small windows. They held 2 families and were none too large, since the birth rate of Port Lowell was the highest in the known universe. This, of course, was hardly surprising, since almost the entire population lay between the ages of 20 and 30, with a few of the senior administrative staff creeping up into the 40s. Every house had a curious porch which puzzled Gibson, until he realized that it was designed to act as an airlock in an emergency. Whittaker had taken him first to the administrative center, the tallest building in the city. If one stood on its roof, one could almost reach up and touch the dome floating above. There was nothing very exciting about admin. It might have been any office building on Earth, with its rows of desks and typewriters and filing cabinets. Main air was much more interesting. This, truly, was the heart of Port Lowell. If it ever ceased to function, the city and all those it held would soon be dead. Gibson had been somewhat vague about the manner in which the settlement obtained its oxygen. At one time, he had been under the impression that it was extracted from the surrounding air, having forgotten that even such scanty atmosphere as Mars possessed contained less than 1% of the gas. Mayor Whittaker had pointed to the great heap of red sand that had been bulldozed in from outside the dome. Everyone called it sand, but it had little resemblance to the familiar sand of Earth. A complex mixture of metallic oxides, it was nothing less than the debris of a world that had rusted to death. "All the oxygen we need's in these ores," said Whittaker, kicking at the caked powder, "and just about every metal you can think of. We've had 1 or 2 strokes of luck on Mars. This is the biggest." He bent down and picked up a lump more solid than the rest. "I'm not much of a geologist," he said, "but look at this. Pretty, isn't it? Mostly iron oxide, they tell me. Iron isn't much use, of course, but the other metals are. About the only one we can't get easily direct from the sand is magnesium.
The best source of that's the old seabed. There are some salt flats 100 meters thick out in Xanthi, and we just go and collect when we need it."
They walked into the low, brightly lit building, towards which a continual flow of sand was moving on a conveyor belt. There was not really a great deal to see, and though the engineer in charge was only too anxious to explain just what was happening, Gibson was content merely to learn that the ores were cracked in electric furnaces, the oxygen drawn off, purified and compressed, and the various metallic messes sent on for more complicated operations. A good deal of water was also produced here, almost enough for the settlement's needs, though other sources were available as well.
"Of course," said Mayor Whittaker, "in addition to storing the oxygen, we've got to keep the air pressure at the correct value and to get rid of the CO2. You realize, don't you, that the dome's kept up purely by the internal pressure and hasn't any other support at all?"
"Yes," said Gibson. "I suppose if that fell off, the whole thing would collapse like a deflated balloon."
"Exactly. We keep 150 millimeters pressure in summer, a little more in winter. That gives almost the same oxygen pressure as in Earth's atmosphere. And we remove the CO2 simply by letting plants do the trick. We imported enough for this job, since the Martian plants don't go in for photosynthesis."
"Hence the hypertrophied sunflowers in Oxford Circus, I suppose?"
"Well, those are intended to be more ornamental than functional. I'm afraid they're getting a bit of a nuisance. I'll have to stop them from spraying seeds all over the city, or whatever it is that sunflowers do. Now let's walk over and look at the farm."
The name was a singularly misleading one for the big food production plants filling Dome 3. The air was quite humid here, and the sunlight was augmented by batteries of fluorescent tubes so that growth could continue day and night. Gibson knew very little about hydroponic farming, and so was not really impressed by the figures which Mayor Whittaker proudly poured into his ear. He could, however, appreciate that one of the greatest problems was meat production, and admire the ingenuity which had partly overcome this by extensive tissue culture and great vats of nutrient fluid.
"It's better than nothing," said the mayor a little wistfully. "But what I wouldn't give for a genuine lamb chop. The trouble with natural meat production is that it takes up so much space, and we simply can't afford it. However, when the new dome's up, we're going to start a little farm with a few sheep and cows. The kids will love it. They've never seen any animals, of course."
This was not quite true, as Gibson was soon to discover. Mayor Whittaker had momentarily overlooked two of Port Lowell's best-known residents. By the end of the tour, Gibson began to suffer from slight mental indigestion. The mechanics of life in the city were so complicated, and Mayor Whittaker tried to show him everything. He was quite thankful when the trip was over and they returned to the mayor's home for dinner.
"I think that's enough for one day," said Whittaker, "but I wanted to show you round because we'll all be busy tomorrow, and I won't be able to spare much time. The chief's away, you know, and won't be back until Thursday, so I've got to look after everything."
"Where's he gone?" asked Gibson, out of politeness rather than real interest.
"Oh, up to Phobos," Whittaker replied with the briefest possible hesitation. "As soon as he gets back, he'll be glad to see you."
The conversation had then been interrupted by the arrival of Mrs. Whittaker and family, and for the rest of the evening Gibson was compelled to talk about Earth. It was his first, but not by any means his last, experience of the insatiable interest which the colonists had in the home planet. They seldom admitted it openly, pretending to a stubborn indifference about the old world and its affairs. But their questions, and above all their rapid reactions to terrestrial criticisms and comments, belied this completely. It was strange to talk to children who had never known Earth, who had been born and had spent all their short lives under the shelter of the great domes. What, Gibson wondered, did Earth mean to them? Was it any more real than the fabulous lands of fairy tales? All they knew of the world from which their parents had emigrated was at second hand, derived from books and pictures. As far as their own senses were concerned, Earth was just another star. They had never known the coming of the seasons. Outside the dome, it was true, they could watch the long winter spread death over the land as the sun descended in the northern sky, could see the strange plants wither and perish to make way for the next generation when spring returned. But no hint of this, came through the protecting barriers of the city. The engineers at the power plant simply threw in more heater circuits and laughed at the worst that Mars could do. Yet these children, despite their completely artificial environment, seemed happy and well, and quite unconscious of all the things which they had missed. Gibson wondered just what their reactions would be if they ever came to Earth. It would be a very interesting experiment, but so far none of the children born on Mars were old enough to leave their parents. The lights of the city were going down when Gibson left the mayor's home after his first day on Mars. He said very little as Whittaker walked back with him to the hotel, for his mind was too full of jumbled impressions. In the morning he would start to sort them out, but at the moment his chief feeling was that the greatest city on Mars was nothing more than an over-mechanized village. Gibson had not yet mastered the intricacies of the Martian calendar, but he knew that the weekdays were the same as on Earth, and that Monday followed Sunday in the usual way. The months also had the same names, but were 50 to 60 days in length. When he left the hotel at what he thought was a reasonable hour, the city appeared quite deserted. There were none of the gossiping groups of people who had watched his progress with such interest on the previous day. Everyone was at work in office, factory, or lab, and Gibson felt rather like a drone who had strayed into a particularly busy hive. He found Mayor Whittaker beleaguered by secretaries and talking into two telephones at once. Not having the heart to intrude, Gibson tiptoed away and started a tour of exploration himself. There was not, after all, any great danger of becoming lost. The maximum distance he would travel in a straight line was less than 0.5 kilometer. It was not the kind of exploration of Mars he had ever imagined in any of his books. So he had passed his first few days in Port Lowell, wandering round and asking questions during working hours, spending the evenings with the families of Mayor Whittaker or other members of the senior staff. Already he felt as if he had lived here for years. There was nothing new to be seen. He had met everyone of importance, up to and including the chief executive himself. But he knew he was still a stranger. He had really seen less than 1,000 millionth of the whole surface of Mars. Beyond the shelter of the dome, beyond the crimson hills, over the edge of the emerald plain, all the rest of this world was mystery.